this is where I get to introduce our speaker. I met our speaker at my home group, Searchers Group, on Saturdays. Well, they're Monday through Thursday, and then Saturday at 11:30. If you want to know more, just come see me. Thursday during our alumni meeting, Eddie asked me to tell everyone about our speaker. And I don't know her very well. So, but the thing about our speaker that really stood out, that stands out to me, first, some of you know who Sam Anders is. And Sam Anders told me about 15 years ago, he said, in recovery, you need to remain teachable. And so I try to always remember that. And every time I listen and hear something Allison has to share during our meetings, I always learn something. And the last time, I don't know, this past September, she was sharing something. I couldn't tell you what it was, but I have it written down in my book. And I'm like, oh, she would be a really good First Friday speaker. And I asked her, and she said yes. And so I am really excited to hear her story. I've never heard it, but I'm excited to hear it. And with that, I give you Allison C.
Everybody, tell you what, that never gets old. I don't know about you, but before I got sober, people were not standing up and saying nice things about me to large groups of people. My name is Allison. I'm an alcoholic. Hi, my sobriety date is March 29th of 1996, and I can assure you that when I got here, I never intended to stay sober that long. But I was surrounded by people who had been sober a really long time and said things like, I probably spilled more than you drank, and that might have been true, but it wasn't very helpful. And they also said, I've been sober longer than you've been alive. And that was also true, but not very helpful. But I also didn't believe that they had been sober that long. And so I'm very aware when I talk to other people who are new or nearly new, and we say, gosh, you know, been sober a long time. For real, every day, all the days from then until now. And I asked them at the time, I said, oh my gosh, how did you do that? Because I had no concept of how you could stay sober that long. And a really crotchety old man who sat in the corner of the meeting that I got sober in said, well, you don't drink and you don't die. So I have not had a drink and I have not died, and I am still here, and I'm excited to share with you all. Dawn, thanks for asking me to be here. My home group is the Searchers Saturday morning group at 11:30. I will be there tomorrow morning. Would love to see you if you're there. I've got some friends here tonight who, when I went back to say hi to them tonight, they said, this better be good. We came out in the cold. So I don't know if it'll be good, but I did pray before I came in that the God of my understanding would use me to be helpful, to be useful, to say something that would be helpful to somebody, even if it's just me. We were talking in the meeting earlier this week about the 12th step and how, you know, sharing our experience, strength, and hope, and carrying the message is the thing that is immunity from drinking for me. I will stay sober tonight, God willing, because I get to tell you what it was like, what happened, and what it's like today. And I will tell you, it has been an adventure. I got sober very young, and so most of my adventure has actually been in sobriety. And I didn't start to make better decisions straight away. So there's a period of sobriety where I continued to make terrible decisions and suffer the consequences, and we'll get there. However, how did I get here? I'm one of those people that really, I could just stand up here and I could read the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous to you, and you would know everything you need to know about me and how to stay sober, because that is what has saved my life. The steps have introduced me to a God of my understanding who has brought me into a way of living that is beyond what I could have ever imagined. And that doesn't mean that everything's great, because when we get to the end of our time together, you will see that right now things are not great for me. I've got my tissues because I'll probably cry. It's really hard, and it's been really hard. But if you don't hear anything else, what I hope you will hear tonight is that we can stay sober no matter what. Conditions do not matter. We can stay sober. And that's the miracle of Alcoholics Anonymous, because if you had asked me when I was new if I would have stayed sober through some of the things that have happened in sobriety, I would have said absolutely not. I get a pass for every single one of those. But that hasn't been the case. So how did I get here? Quickly. Alcoholism set to kill me very quickly. When I drink, I black out, I throw up, I fight, and then I pass out. And you don't do that very long successfully. At least I did not. I had a very short, I'm a child of the 80s. I'm an 80s hair band fan, and Def Leppard, better to burn out than fade away. That was my drinking career. I burned out very fast. And when I got here, people would say things like, "Oh, you're so lucky you got here so young." And I was so pissed off. I mean, y'all had 20, 30 extra years run, and I was really jealous. But alcoholism kicked my butt substantially very fast, and I got here not a minute too soon or too late. I grew up in a very normal family. If you looked on the list of what I thought made an alcoholic, it's not my life. I'm one of those people that it says if a mere code of morals or a better philosophy of living were sufficient to overcome alcoholism, I wouldn't need to be here. I grew up in a family where my parents are about to celebrate 54 years of marriage. They're happy. They provided for us. We had a stable home. I've got a younger sister. There's two of us. She's very normal. There's no other alcoholism in my immediate family, except for me. But I did find out later in recovery that both of my grandfathers, my one grandfather died of alcoholism, my other grandfather was managed by his wife. But in my immediate circumstances, there was no instability, there was no crazy. And I remember when I was young, my parents would have people over before they would go out for the night for hors d'oeuvres and drinks. And I remember laying in my bed and hearing the laughter downstairs and the clinking of the glasses. And it's just exactly like what Bill describes about the gay crowd at the bar down the hall in his story. That was downstairs at my house growing up. And I just remember thinking, that sounds like what happy is. And I didn't have the vocabulary to describe it at the time, but now looking back, I can say, oh, I thought that's what happy was. And so I would run around and finish up all the leftover drinks when I was little. and it wasn't until I was 13 or 14, and I had gone on vacation with a friend and her family. And we went to the beach, and we were in one of those resorts where if you could, you know, the bar was about this tall, and I was about the same height I am now, and if you could see over the bar, they would give you whatever you wanted. And I ordered Long Island iced teas. I know, y'all know. I did not know at the time what was coming, but man, do they go down smooth. And I had several. And then I went back to where I had hid the key of the room that I had snuck out of to go to the bar. And I leaned over to get the key, and I fell face first down in the sand. And I thought, I am home. Oh, that sense of ease and comfort that comes from taking a few drinks. Because I didn't know that I was suffering from the dis-ease of alcoholism. I was so uncomfortable in my own skin. And it had nothing to do with circumstances, because my outside life was very comfortable, but I was uncomfortable from the beginning, and I was looking for that sense of ease and comfort that I get from taking a few drinks, and I thought, man, this is it. And I chased that for as long as I could. And I did not become a daily drinker at 13, but I wanted to be. And it wasn't until high school, you know, I lived the double life. I was very successful in school. I was, you know, getting good grades, participating in stuff, doing all the things that you were supposed to do, keeping it together, and on the inside I was crumbling, and I was drinking every single chance I could get. As I mentioned, when I drink, I black out, I throw up, I fight, and then I pass out. And so it doesn't take much before trouble comes. And I found as much trouble as you can find in short order. I graduated from, I should mention, I have two teenagers, and I have loved their dad in one form or another since I was 14 years old. We drank together. He was instrumental in my sobriety, getting sober, and you'll hear more about him later. But I went away to college because that's what you did. And I went very far away because I am a geographic cure kind of person. If it's farther away, it must be better. But everywhere I go, I bring me. And so I moved across the country to go to college and brought me with me. And set to drinking, and I was very successful at drinking and not very successful at college. So, have a sip of my water. My roommate, I lived in a dorm, And I had a roommate, and we lived in a room about the size of this podium. And I mean, bless her, because I was a disaster to live with. And the girl who lived across the hall from us also became a very good friend. And they watched me, and they watched my drinking. And I didn't know that that's what they were doing, but they were. And it turns out they were making some observations, and they were talking to other people because they were concerned. And things were not going well for me, and things were not going well for the people around me when I was drinking, for all of the reasons that I mentioned. And so one particular night in April of 1995, I had had a big night, which I do not remember. And what I do remember is that every morning I would wake up, sort of check my surroundings. Any other blackout drinkers in the room? You wake up, you check your surroundings. And then you get up, and it's either, whew, okay, or, oh, boy. And this was an okay kind of morning. I was in my bed. I was where I was supposed to be. And I got up, and I went out, and I was walking down the hall to go to the bathroom, and people are moving to the other side of the hallway and looking down. And I knew it was really bad, but I didn't know what it was. I had a rage problem. And when you pour, I mentioned that I fight, but like I really fight when you pour alcohol in. And in high school, I had had some fighting training. It was to help release some of the rage, but really what it did was train me to be dangerous. And so it turns out I had assaulted somebody the night before, my roommate, it turns out, in a pretty significant fashion. And I'm grateful to this day, and I don't understand why there were a whole bunch of people involved. She didn't call the police. She called her dad, who happened to be a member of Alcoholics Anonymous, who'd been sober 8 years at the time. And our friend across the hall called her mom, who happened to be an addiction counselor. I didn't know any of that at the time. And they came to me, and I remember sitting in the little common area, and it was snowing. I lived in a place that was cold. And I'm watching the snow fall, and I had that moment of clarity where I thought, I can't do this anymore. Alcohol is killing me, and I'm desperate for it, and I don't care what the consequences are because I just can't stand to feel how I feel anymore, and I will ride this train all the way to the end, and we're nearly there, and I don't care. But I need to do something different, and I didn't know what to do. And they came to me, and my roommate said, hey, will you talk to my dad? And I said, no. And she said, well, then will you listen to him? And I said, okay. And I got on the phone with her dad, who lived in a different state, and he 12-stepped me over the phone, and he told me about his drinking, and he told me about how he got sober. And he couldn't see me, but I was holding the phone, nodding my head, like we do in here when we hear things that we can relate to. And he described me to a T, and he was sober. And they had gotten a list of meetings in the area, and the girl across the hall drove a hatchback. They loaded me into the trunk of the hatchback, drove me to the church in town where the meeting was that night, and dropped me off in the parking lot and said, we'll be back in an hour. And I went into the room, and it was men in black robes, and I thought, my God, it is worse than I imagined. And they took one look at me and said, oh, let us get you to the right room. And they brought, it was a meeting of the priests, I didn't know, it was terrible, I was in a fog. And I don't remember very much, but they got me to the right room, and all I remember is that it was a room full of people who were smiling, and they were laughing, and they were introducing themselves as alcoholics, and they were talking about stuff that I could relate to but couldn't imagine anyone talking about. And they were saying things that I did, and they were smiling. And I thought, I don't understand what is happening here, because this is not funny. And the reason that they were smiling and laughing is because they weren't doing those things anymore, and I was still doing them. And I introduced myself as an alcoholic, and I cried the rest of the meeting. And at the end, all of these women came up to me, and they said, are you going to be okay until tomorrow? And I was that mix of super cocky and stupid, and desperate, but not quite desperate enough. And I was like, yes, I'm fine. What do you mean? Am I going to be fine till the meeting tomorrow? And they gave me their phone numbers, and they said, call before you drink. And I had no idea that when I walked out of that room, not only was I not going to be fine until the next day, but I was not going to know what to do with myself because I'd not been sober for 24 hours and as long as I could remember. And it was miserable. I started going to tons of meetings. I didn't have a car. I couldn't drive. but a woman took me under her wing who had a car, and she met me at the flagpole at the top of the hill of this little town where I lived every night and said, get in the car. And I've heard it in here before, and it's my experience. I thought the first step was get in the car. And I got in the car, and we went wherever we were going. We went to tons of meetings, and we did fun, sober stuff. We were in a little bitty town where there were more bars per capita than anywhere else in the country at the time, and so there was a lot of drinking, and they found other stuff to do. But what I did not do was get a sponsor or work the steps. I just went to a lot of meetings and hung out. And I've heard that described in here as like loading the slingshot, where you're pulling it back and pulling it back and pulling it back. And it was March the following, that was April through the following March. And I just couldn't anymore, because I couldn't imagine life with alcohol, and I couldn't imagine life without it. And I didn't have a sufficient solution. And I drank. And I moved. I mentioned I moved a lot. In between that time, I had moved back home. I was living in upstate New York. My family was in Texas. I'd moved back to Texas. And y'all, I don't even remember what happened. I was thinking about it on the way over here. There was no event. Like, I don't think I was even upset about anything. It's just because I'm an alcoholic and I couldn't stand to be uncomfortable anymore. And I drank a couple of times in short order, and the predictable results happened. And the last time that I drank, I remember the second I took it in, the connection that I had with the God of my understanding disappeared, and it was like a wet blanket of fear just landed on me. It was a physical experience, and I thought, oh my gosh. That man I mentioned, the father of my children, was, you know, along for the ride this whole time. He's watching me self-destruct and ratted me out to my parents. I was so angry. And they came with black trash bags and loaded my stuff into black trash bags and hauled me home. And at the time, I was so upset. And now I am so grateful, because they could have just said, we're done. We don't want anything to do with you. And so I came back home, and I got a job in the morning, and I went to an outpatient program in the afternoon, and I went to a meeting every day at noon. And it was a meeting we sat in a circle around the outside of the room, and we went around, and it was all business people on their lunch break. It was in a business park area, and me. And I was 20 years old, I was a hot mess, and I, you know, not really employable, not really sane. And I went to lunch with them afterwards, and I had told some of the girls in my group that I'd picked the woman I was going to ask to be my sponsor. Her name was Judy T. And I was nervous, because it felt like I was proposing. I made it very dramatic. And we went to lunch, and one of the girls said to Judy, she said, oh, I'm so excited Allison's asked you to be her sponsor. And I hadn't asked her yet. And it was fine. I think that was God doing for me what I couldn't do for myself. But that started the beginning of a crazy wild adventure in sobriety. And I got sober that meeting. The steps were up on the wall like they are here. And I went through them, and I read, and I determined in advance the ones that I thought did not apply, or that I could skip and still be successful. And so if it didn't involve talking to someone else or writing something down, I thought, yes, okay, which 6 and 7, haha, if you've been sober any amount of time. And then I thought I might skip 11. 3 I wasn't sure about, because it had that, you know, capital G word in there that I also had a problem with. But what happened for me was that my life was unmanageable. And I knew that I was powerless over alcohol. And I wanted to drink for the first 3 months of my sobriety every minute of every day. And I went to meetings, and I wanted to drink. And I went to meetings, and I wanted to drink. And I talked to my sponsor, and I answered the phone. I got sober at a clubhouse in Dallas, Texas. And there was I don't know if it was like the equivalent of the hotline here, but the phone for central office rolled to that meeting's little office area when they were closed. And so I just sat in that office, and I smoked cigarettes, and I answered the phone. And people were asking directions. I mean, I didn't have any information to be useful, but they put the meeting book in front of me and told me what to say. And I got a service job. I was the ashtray washer, because you could smoke in meetings then. And I really wanted to be promoted to coffee maker. But that was Crazy Bob's job, because in AA we have all these funny nicknames. Crazy Bob was the coffee maker, and he was not giving it up. So I stayed as ashtray washer until I moved again. But I got to know a lot of alcoholics, and I got to be around people who were sober and living successfully, and I got to know that I could stay sober even if I wanted to drink, because I had never had that experience before. I had always just drank when I wanted to drink. And it was understanding this idea that I was powerless over alcohol and that my life had become unmanageable. And there's a line at the end of Bill's story that says, an alcoholic in his cups is an unlovely creature. And that was absolutely me before I got to Alcoholics Anonymous. I was an unlovely creature. But then it also says, in the doctor's opinion at the end, y'all get a load of this. Dr. Silkworth says at the end of his talk, his letter, he says, you may rely absolutely on anything they say about themselves. Was that true about y'all when you were drinking? Because it was not true about me. You could not rely on anything I said about myself. And so I started to learn that when I stopped drinking, there was going to be more changes that were going to happen. And the only way that they were going to happen was if I worked the steps. And Judy T. started to take me through those steps. And she explained to me about the allergy of the body, the obsession of the mind, all of the stuff that it says in the book. And this line about men and women drink essentially because they like the effect produced by alcohol. But the one that really got me, because I had loopholes in my mind, you know, I'm too young, I'm too smart, I'm too this, I'm too that, y'all are too weird, you know, reasons why I couldn't be alcoholic. And then we got to this part on page 33, where it says, to be gravely affected, one does not necessarily have to drink a long time, nor take the quantities some of us have. This is particularly true of women. Potential female alcoholics often turn into the real thing and are gone beyond recall in a few years. And I thought, they have nailed me. That is me. I admitted I was powerless over alcohol and that my life had become unmanageable. And they told me that I didn't have to like it, because I really didn't like it. I was real mad about it. And they said, well, that sort of doesn't matter. It's, you know, you can be mad about it and stay sober. And I did. And I sat in the back of the room, and I crossed my arms, and I growled at people if they got too close to me. I mean, I really, and people like me now, I hated the smiling, happy people that were talking and knew people and were laughing and would say things like, I'm so grateful to be sober. And I'm like, that's a bunch of crap. And I wanted to punch them, because I used to punch people a lot. And the longer I've stayed here, I have turned into one of those happy, smiling alcoholics who's grateful to be sober. And the reason that I'm grateful is because there's a solution, because I don't have to live that way anymore. And so we were going through the steps. She was taking me through the book, and we got to two, came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. And I conveniently had a very narrow definition of what it meant to be insane. And it involved a bathrobe, a brown UPS hat. I remember this like it was yesterday. And you had to be living under a bridge. And I was not living under a bridge in a bathrobe with a brown UPS hat on, so I was good. But she explained, it's doing the same thing over and over and expecting different results. And when I applied that formula to the way that I was living my life, I could not deny that I had been behaving insanely and that I needed to be restored if I was going to be able to stay here. And she explained that I could come to, and then I could come to believe. And that's what happened for me, because I walked in the door just desperate for you all to be wrong about the fact that this worked. I could tell that it was working for you, but I was certain that I was going to be the exception, and it was not going to work for me, and I didn't want to have to do it this way, and I want, you know, terminal uniqueness, that was me. But I had a moment where I remember sitting in the meeting. I remember exactly where I was. I was in the smoking side, which was different from the business meeting side. And I was sitting at the table, and Vic was chairing the meeting, and he always played with this pen that made this really clicking noise that drove me crazy. And I realized, oh my gosh, I don't want to drink. And it was the first time I had felt that way in sobriety. And for me, that was the start of being restored to sanity. And it was learning how to make different decisions than I had been making before that led to better outcomes. If I didn't like what I was getting, I had to do something different. And I did not know that. That did not seem clear to me when I got here. You all had to explain that to me. If you don't like what you're getting, stop doing what you're doing. And that was the sum up of step two for me. I had to come to believe in a power greater than myself that could enable me to do things differently. And it says in our book, lack of power, that was our dilemma. And we had to find a power greater than ourselves. And that led me into step three. And I fought step three. I looked at that. I had, because it talks about in the book about we have a relationship with our Creator based on simple and understandable terms. I was afraid of the terms. What if it's hard? What if this God that I turn my will and my life over to makes me do stuff I don't want to do? And I had a specific list of things that I might have to do that I might not want to, and they were completely unreasonable and have never happened. It did not occur to me to think about the things that might actually happen. And in fact, I did make a list. I made a list of, if any of these things happen, I will get to drink. And they were all good things. Like, when I turn, if, because I did not think I was going to live, if I turn 21, if I graduate from college, ooh, if I get married, if it's New Year's Eve, I mean, stupid stuff. But it didn't occur to me to put on hard things. Like, what if my mom gets cancer? Which is what happened right about the time I got to the third step. And I had made a decision to turn my will and my life over to the care of God. Didn't understand him at the time. And my sponsor worked with me. And she said, just make a decision. See what happens. What's the worst thing that could happen? You could just keep living the way that you're living, which is terrible. Why don't you try something different? And then my mom got sick. And this was a couple of years. I'm jumping around a little bit because I had come to made that decision, gotten, you know, stayed a little bit sober, gotten a job. I was functioning in life a little better. And my mom got sick. And I remember thinking, that is not one of the terms that I'm okay with. And my mother and I really butted heads. And I used to joke that we could not live in the same state. It was just better if we didn't. But it was one of those moments where I was like, I may not like her, but don't mess with her. And I went to God and I shook my fist and said, thank you very much. You can handle the alcoholism part, but the rest of it, I don't care for your choices. I'll take it from here. And I ran my life into the ground in sobriety. Just self will run riot. And I think about it now, and nothing, by the grace of God, nothing terrible happened. But I did a bunch of stupid stuff and, you know, moved and changed jobs, and there were some hymns, and it was just a, you know, it was a hot mess. It was character defects on parade with no alcohol. And I got miserable very quickly. And I got back into working the steps. And I remember at the time, and I said this in my home group the other day, I called my sponsor. I had moved by then, and a woman named Sue was sponsoring me. And she said, I said, why is this happening? And she said, I don't know. Maybe it's because one day some women in Alcoholics Anonymous will need to hear how to stay sober through this. And I told her they could find someone else because there were plenty of other women in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I didn't need to have this experience. But she walked me through coming back to turning my will and my life over to a God of my understanding, to the care. She kept saying, Allison, it says the care of God. God is not out to get you. And I don't have enough time to get into that whole process, but it saved my life because I had to get back to a place where this God that was keeping me sober could also be trusted to manage the rest of my life. Because what I've learned in here, and it says it's in the family afterward. It says, sensation of drinking is but the first step away from a highly strained, abnormal condition. I got sober, and I thought that nothing bad was ever going to happen again. I don't know why I thought that. You all did not tell me that, but that's what I heard. And that I was going to go back to being the smart, capable, highly functioning person that I thought I was before. And it turns out I was just an alcoholic who hadn't had anything to drink, and I needed a solution. And so I had to have the God of my understanding, because I can't do any of this without God. And I've proven that over and over again in sobriety. I've tried it a couple of times. If you can learn anything from me, don't do that. It works better not to, but I tried. And so we got to the fourth step, and it says at the end of the third step in the book that after we've, you know, said the prayer and done the thing, that we vigorously launch into the fourth step. I did not. I skidded like a puppy that's put their paws out and is like, I'm not going, and is drug across the floor. And I resisted because I was afraid. And it says searching and fearless, and I didn't know how to be searching or fearless. And so I went to the meeting, that same meeting I mentioned where it was a circle of the businessmen and me, and we went around the room, and they would read something from the literature and go around the room, and when it got to you, you could share. But the rule was very clear. If it was on a step that you had not worked, you had to pass. There was no, well, I haven't done this step, but I think, no. Zip it, pass. And so we were on the fourth step, and it came around to me, and I hadn't done a fourth step yet, and I had to pass. And I still had a very big ego. And afterwards, my sponsor, who knew this, said that I had to stay in the kiddie pool, and I could not play in the big pool with the other alcoholics until I had done fourth step. She played me. It worked. I went home, and I started writing, and the first one was not searching, or it was searching, but it was not fearless, and it was not thorough, but it was a start. And it was enough to get started and to keep going. And it has not been the only one I've done. And the ones since then have been more searching and more fearless and more thorough. And there's been more material. And this is like, you know, I've heard people say the program's like an onion. We peel the layers. The further down, the more it stinks. Certainly has been for me. And I've needed this step because I got to hurry up. We're going to fast forward a little bit. Meanwhile, as I'm getting sober, I went back to college, I graduated, I got a big fancy job, I got to travel all over the world, I got to go to Alcoholics Anonymous meetings in tons of different countries, I was living a very fancy, fun life, it was great, I miss it some days. but I also was, you know, in my 20s and doing stuff that stupid 20-year-olds do. And the guy, my kid's father, had told me he was never going to marry me, which I found very unfortunate, but I believed him. And so I met a man in Alcoholics Anonymous, and we got married, and it was not a good match. And I shouldn't have married him, knew it at the time, did it anyway, because I was still pretty rebellious. And then I really needed a fourth and fifth step, and I did. And that did not go well. And I mentioned before that I thought that once I got sober, nothing bad would ever happen. And I really believed that there was a specific point in sobriety where if you reached that milestone, it was like you got to go in the secret club. And nothing bad happened to the people in the secret club. And for me, that was 10 years. And when I went to pick up my 10-year chip at my home group, I was in the middle of a divorce from that man who was also a member of Alcoholics Anonymous in that same home group. And one of the women in the meeting came up to me afterwards. We were both in the same meeting. And she goes, man, that was just so uncomfortable for me. And I thought, for you. But I really needed these steps. And I had to admit to God, to myself, and to another human being the exact nature of my wrongs in that circumstance. Because I made a lot of wrong choices and I did a lot of wrong things. And I'm glad it wasn't my first fourth and fifth, but it was the one that's the most meaningful when I think back through the steps, because I just behaved in a way that I wish I hadn't. And when I was newly sober, a woman said to me, Allison, I hope you stay sober long enough to be embarrassed by your behavior in early sobriety. And I have. And I am. And also some of my behavior in not early sobriety. But that's what the steps are for. It does not say, you know, it says we are not perfect adherents to these principles. I have not perfectly adhered to the principles, but I have kept coming back. And if nothing else, my participation in Alcoholics Anonymous is the thing that I have done the most consistently for the longest time of anything I've ever done in my life. I've never lived anywhere this long. I've never had a job of, you know, one job this long, nothing. I've never done anything as long as I've been a member of Alcoholics Anonymous, and that is what has saved me. And so I got to do a fourth and a fifth on that marriage, and afterwards I got a real good look at the 6 and 7 character defects, and that was, you know, I laugh about how those are the steps that I was going to skip initially. I've spent more time on 6 and 7 in sobriety than probably anything else, and I was painfully aware of my defects of character. And I did humbly ask God to remove them from me. But what I was not willing to do quite yet was to make amends. I had done plenty of amends before. I had made amends to my family. I had, you know, given back some money that I had taken from people. I had done the easy stuff. But what, I don't know about y'all, but for me, it's the stuff that I've done in sobriety that's been a lot harder to make amends for, because there's no excuse. There's no, oh, I was drunk, all my drinking stuff. Nope. I just was a basket case, sober woman who behaved poorly and made choices based on character defects that now I need to own. And so that process of making the list of all the persons we had harmed and becoming willing to make amends to them all, I always mention that becoming willing part, because that was a process for me. I did not start off willing particularly with this particular person. And my sponsor at the time said, you just pray. You just ask. You ask and you ask and you ask. And I did. And my prayer started off something like, God, I don't want to be willing, but Lizzie said I had to pray this prayer. So I'm praying it. And this is with, I don't know, 12 years of sobriety. I'm a sometimes slowly kind of person. I did not get well very quickly. But what happened was I had already, I had moved to Atlanta. I had gotten married again to my children's father. He had gotten sober. And about 5 minutes later, we got married and had a couple of kids. And actually, and he, you know, he was actually a guest. He and his mom were guests at my first wedding. That didn't work out. Can't make it up, but that's how it happened. And so he knew, and I woke up one day and I said that prayer again, and it had gotten a little bit less grating and a little more sincere as time went by. And I woke up one morning and I realized I was willing. And I sort of freaked out and didn't know what to do. So I called Lizzie and I said, oh my gosh, I'm willing. What do I do? And she said, you know what to do. And I made an appointment and I got to make that amends to my first husband. And it went, I did not have any expectations. I had had some amends where people, you know, didn't care. Some where they didn't want to hear from me. Some where they were really glad I was sober. You know, kind of the whole gamut. And I had also had one person make an amends to me that was not how it's described in the book. And she said, I'm really sorry. And that was it. And I don't know about you all, but I said, I'm really sorry a lot when I was drinking. And I also said, I'm really sorry a lot in sobriety. But I was taught that making an amends is changing. I'm changing my behavior. I'm owning the things that I did. And then I'm not doing it anymore. And so I was really aware that I wanted to do it correctly and I needed to be ready. And when I made that phone call, it went better than anticipated. And I went back to that town where we both lived several months after that. And I was at a dinner with a bunch of friends. And one of our mutual friends made some, you know, snotty comment about, hey, Allison, don't you wish Steve was here? And I said, actually, yeah. I wouldn't mind seeing him at all. And I thought, that is the freedom that we get because I can look the world in the eye. The nine-step promises have come true for me. I don't have to duck when I hear the sound of a certain truck. I don't have to drive a different way. I don't have to not look myself in the eye in the mirror. There's all sorts of things that I get to do because of the freedom that we get from doing these steps. And I did not know that. I could not have told you that. I did not believe you at the time. But it's absolutely been true for me. So here we are. I've made that amends. I'm living in Atlanta. We're married. We've got kids. I'm, you know, a stay-at-home mom and living the dream life and continued to take personal inventory. And when we were wrong, promptly admitted it. When, not if by some misunderstanding on your part, you think that there's been an error, which is how I read it for a long time. When. And that's been an adventure. I have a friend who says, you know, in the step in the big book, it says continue to watch for selfishness, dishonesty, resentment, and fear. And she always says, it doesn't say wait for them. It says watch for them and keep your side of the street clean. And I have done that better in some times than others. I will tell you that the last several years have been, I mentioned at the beginning, they've been very challenging. I have two teenagers. They both have significant mental health issues. When my now 15-year-old was 12, he had to go away to treatment, and he was gone for 2.5 years. He just came back in May. He's been home for 6 months. My 13-year-old went to treatment earlier, a couple of months ago, and for mental health stuff, she's home, and they're both having a hard time. And this sobriety is not for sissies, I'll tell you what. I was told that early on, and it's true. It's real easy to drink. Some days it's hard to stay sober when the real life is happening. And we've had a lot of ups and downs. I have had to seek through prayer and meditation to improve my conscious contact with God as I understood him, praying only for knowledge of his will for us and the power to carry that out, because there are so many days when I do not know what to do. I don't know how to handle it. But that God of my understanding that I shook my fist at all those years ago, this will make me cry, has never abandoned me, no matter what. And there are so many times now where I think, I don't understand your plan, but I know that there is one, and I trust you, because there has not been a time where I've come to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous and said, okay, y'all, this is what's happening. I don't know what to do. And people in the meeting have never said, I'm so sorry, Allison, you're the first person in Alcoholics Anonymous who's ever had to do that. We don't know what to tell you. Good luck. That's never happened. There's always been somebody who says, let me tell you how I did it sober. Or, I'm not sure, but Susie's done it sober. Why don't you talk to Susie? And that is the way that God works through you all to help me stay sober. And to do the thing that's in front of me, right? It was just, I was told early on, just don't stop walking. When it's really crappy, just don't stop. Keep going one foot in front of the other. We trudge the road of happy destiny. And I know what it means to trudge today. I have had a spiritual awakening as the result of these steps. And because of that, I'm here carrying the message to you all tonight and attempting to practice these principles in all my affairs. And I will tell you very briefly, because my part's done, that my affairs in the last year and a half have not been to my liking. As I said, my son was away for a long time, really having a hard time. My daughter has been having a hard time. In the middle of all of that, that man I've loved since I was 14 years old came and said, I don't want to do this anymore. And I'm in the middle of a very expensive, very long divorce. And in the last 6 months, I sold our house. I bought a house for just me. I went back to work. I started a new career. I started grad school at night, and I'm staying sober 1 minute at a time. And it's not hard to stay sober, but sometimes it's just hard to breathe. And what I know, because you all have taught me, is that I can do this with we, not me, we. And when I was brand new, they said, if your ass falls off, put it in a bag and take it to a meeting. And I carry a bag around with me a lot lately. And I bring it to meetings, and I'm here, and I'm practicing these principles in all of my affairs, and I'm behaving in a way that I don't have to be embarrassed about if I stay sober a little bit longer. And I have peace that makes no sense. Not because things are the way that I want them to, but because I absolutely know that that God that I turn my will and my life over to is going to take care of me. And that this is not the end, this is the beginning of something. And when I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, I thought it was the end, that I was going to have to hang on to a chair and stay sober miserably for a long time because people in my family live a really long time. And I did not know that it was going to be the beginning of a crazy adventure. And so you all have taught me how to have a new perspective and how to reframe things. And so I get to reframe all the time. Okay, this is not the end, this is a beginning. And there have been people in Alcoholics Anonymous already who have needed this experience. And I mostly prefer to share things after the fact, once I'm through them and I can tell you what it was like, what happened and what it's like now. But I'm in the middle of this one, so y'all are getting it as it's unfolding. And I don't know what's going to happen, but I do know that I can stay sober no matter what. So glad to be here. Thanks.
Awesome.